a question with the President of the Senate, and I think it's a reasonable way of handling consideration of the contract. Expect we will be appointing a House Special Committee on it tomorrow. Communications.
I have no communications, Mr. Speaker.
Reports of standing committees.
I have no reports of standing committees.
Reports of special committees.
No, Mr. Speaker.
Introduction of resolutions.
House Joint Resolution Number 7 by Bradley and Malone, proposing amendments to the Constitution of the State of Alaska, providing for a unicameral legislature.
State Affairs and Judiciary.
House Joint Resolution Number 8 by Bradley, inviting the President of the United States to address the Alaska Legislature.
Rules. Mr. Bradley. Mr. Bradley moves and asks unanimous consent that House Joint Resolution Number 8, inviting the President of the United States to address the Alaska Legislature, be sponsored by all members of the House. Hearing no objection, so ordered.
House Concurrent Resolution Number 6 by Bradley and Cotton, congratulating the Chugiak Eagle River Star.
Rules.
I have no further resolutions for introduction, Mr. Speaker.
Introduction, first reading and reference of bills.
House Bill Number 45 by Freeman, Duncan, Eliason, Gardner, Haugen, Miller, Specking, and Swanson, an act relating to employment with the Alaska Marine Highway System.
State Affairs and Finance.
House Bill Number 46 by Rudd, Specking, Brown, Eliason, Miles, and Gardner, an act relating to the sale of intoxicating liquor.
Commerce.
House Bill Number 47 by Swanson, Bradley, Chatterton, Hayes, McKinnon, Meekins, Miles, Parr, and Phillips, an act relating to creation of a utility corridor for extension of the Alaska Railroad and providing for an effective date.
State Affairs and Finance.
House Bill Number 48 by Swanson, Bradley, Chatterton, Hayes, McKinnon, Meekins, Miles, Parr, and Phillips, an act making a special appropriation to the Department of Highways, Interior Division, for delineation of a utility corridor and railroad right-of-way for extension of the Alaska Railroad and providing for an effective date.
State Affairs and Finance. Mr. Miles.
It is on it, I'm sorry.
Mr. Miles' name will be reflected as co-sponsor on House Bill 48. Are there further bills for introduction?
House Bill Number 49 by Bradley, Greening, Miles, and Parr, an act relating to the number of state employees and providing for an effective date.
State Affairs and Judiciary.
House Bill Number 50 by Gardner and Bradley, an act relating to the termination, continuation, and reestablishment of regulatory boards and commissions.
State Affairs and Judiciary.
I have no further bills for introduction, Mr. Speaker.
We have no calendar for today.
Yes.
Unfinished business?
We do have a calendar.
Excuse me. Consideration of the daily calendar. The House will stand at ease.
On it with just a little check, and I missed it. It is on all of them. 47 and 48. Oh, you didn't want to be on? Oh, I see. Oh. I did, because I, when we were in the room. Okay, I'm sorry. I got
48.
Yeah. Okay. It's all straightened out.
We directed that my name be on the appropriation bill to the chair.
Yeah.
I just got to read all the bills last night, and there's some that I'd like to be co-sponsored. Is it too late?
Well, you could just stand up and announce it, and we would put it in the journal. Okay. And then if it ever is reprinted, your name would be put on it.
Oh, yeah, I don't
need it. Yeah. Yeah, just stand up and see. Mike? Yes. You want to write it down?
House, please come back to order. Mr. Miller?
Mr. Speaker, apparently a number of representatives would like to join as co-sponsors to some legislation that was sponsored yesterday. We had said yesterday that if anybody wanted to join as a sponsor, they should bills would be on the clerk's desk or in the clerk's office for a short time after the session, and then people should go up and sign on. But because the first day's confusion and everything like that, I think probably didn't happen. If today you still want to join on as a sponsor on a bill that was announced yesterday or today for that matter, you can stand up at this time and ask unanimous consent that your name be shown as a co-sponsor on that legislation. That will put your name in the journal as a co-sponsor. It will not put your name on the bill itself because the bills have already been printed. But but that will put your name in the journal as a co-sponsor, and then later on, if a committee substitute comes out of that in that little section up there where it says original sponsors, I guess your name probably will appear up there as well. At this time, if anybody wants to bail on to any of the bills yesterday or today, just as I say, stand up and name the bill and ask to be shown as a co-sponsor.
Mr. Greening? Is there objection? No objection. So ordered. Mr. Meekins?
Speaker, I also would like to be shown as a co-sponsor on House Bill 5, also on House Bill 13.
Is there objection? Hearing no objection. So ordered. The rule that Mr. Miller described applying to bailing onto a bill also applies to bailing off of a bill. Mr. Miller?
Sponsors for your bills, it's going to be
Okay, we're down to consideration of the daily calendar. Mr. Swanson?
I'd like to be on my name placed on House Bill 5.
Mr. Swanson moves and asks unanimous consent to be shown as a co-sponsor on House Bill 5. Hearing no objection, it's ordered. Mr. Phillips? House will stand at ease. House will please come back to order. Mr. Duncan?
Mr. Speaker, I would also like to have my name reflected in the journal as a co-sponsor on House Bill 5.
Mr. Duncan moves and asks unanimous consent that he be reflected as a co-sponsor in House Bill 5. Hearing no objection, so ordered. Mr. Kelly?
Mr. Speaker, I move that I be placed on HB1, HB5, HB6, HB39 as a co-sponsor.
You've heard the motion. If there's no objection, it's adopted. Mr. Chatterton? Mr. Chatterton moves and asks unanimous consent that he be shown as a co-sponsor in House Bill 5. Hearing no objection, so ordered. Mr. Miles? Mr. Miles moves and asks unanimous consent that he be placed as a co-sponsor in House Bill 5. Hearing no objection, so ordered. I would ask the members to please use their microphones. The system is working now. Mr. Eliason?
Mr. Speaker, I have no journal from yesterday, so would you tell us what House Bill 5 is?
I don't have the list in front of me. It's a bill dealing with senior citizens. Perhaps Mr. Brad would like to elaborate. Mr. Rode.
Mr. Speaker, you are the co-sponsor on that bill. It is the exemption. It's an act relating to exemption from real property taxes for senior citizens. Remember, this was amended last year, this bill, to eliminate some people because apparently of income reasons. Now, the bill is a repeal of what happened last year, but this can be worked over in committee. In fact, I have an amendment that I want to put on it myself, and we could limit this exemption to income if necessary.
Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Speaker, if the motion's in order, I'll move and ask unanimous consent that House Bill 5 be shown as sponsored by all members of the House.
The motion is in order. Mr. Freeman moves and asks unanimous consent that the House Bill 5 be shown as being sponsored by all members of the House. There's objection.
Mr. Speaker, I'll withdraw the motion.
Is there objection to withdrawing the motion? Hearing no objection, the motion is withdrawn. Mr. Osi. Mr. Osi moves and asks unanimous consent to be shown as a co-sponsor in House Bill 5. Hearing no objection, it's so ordered. Mr. Hayes. Mr. Hayes moves and asks unanimous consent that his name be shown as a co-sponsor on House Bill Number 5. Hearing no objection, it's so ordered. Representative Smith?
I move and ask unanimous consent that I be added to House Bill 5 also.
Representative Smith moves and asks unanimous consent that she be shown as a co-sponsor on House Bill 5. Hearing no objection, it's so ordered. Mr. Dankworth? Mr. Dankworth moves and asks unanimous consent to be shown as a co-sponsor in House Bill 5. Hearing no objection, so ordered. If there are more than one or two more people that want to be shown as co-sponsors, I'm not going to repeat the formal motion each time. But if you have an objection to someone being shown as a co-sponsor, please state it. Mr. Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, I would also like to have my name placed on House Bill 5.
Is there objection? Hearing no objection, so ordered. Mr. Freeman? Hearing no objection, so ordered. Mr. Urien?
In order to ensure passage, Mr. Speaker, I'd like my name to go.
Hearing no objection. So ordered. Mr. Lathine?
Mr. Speaker, I'd like my name on House Bill 5, please.
Hearing no objection, so ordered. Mr. Eliason.
Speaker, don't leave me out.
Hearing no objection, so ordered. There are other bills upon which people wish to be shown as co-sponsors? If not, that brings us down to consideration of the daily calendar. The first item on the calendar is House Concurrent Resolution Number 1. Would the clerk please read House Concurrent Resolution Number 1 in second reading?
House Concurrent Resolution Number 1 by all members of the House, honoring the memory of Ralph J. Rivers.
The resolution is before you. Question is, shall House Concurrent Resolution Number 1 pass the House? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Let the record show that House Concurrent Resolution Number 1 passed the House unanimously. Next item on the daily calendar is House Concurrent Resolution Number 4. Will the clerk please read House Concurrent Resolution Number 4 in second reading?
House Concurrent Resolution Number 4 by all members of the House, honoring the memory of a great Alaskan, Vitey G. Bartlett.
House Concurrent Resolution Number 4 is before you for discussion and debate. The question is, shall House Concurrent Resolution Number 4 pass the House? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Let the record show that House Concurrent Resolution Number 4 passed the House unanimously. That brings us to the end of today's calendar and down to unfinished business. Mr. Miles. Mr. Miles moves and asks unanimous consent that we recess the House for the purpose of majority caucus. The House please stand at ease. Will the House please come back to order? Mr. Miles?
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to withdraw my motion to recess at this time.
Mr. Miles moves and asks unanimous consent that his motion to recess at this time be withdrawn. Hearing no objection, motion carries. There are other matters under unfinished business. Special orders. Announcement of committee meetings. Representative Rudd.
Mr. Speaker, the Community and Regional Affairs Committee will hold its first meeting on Tuesday at 9 a.m. in room 625 of the court building. That's on the sixth floor of the court building.
Mr. Miller.
Mr. Speaker, before too many announcements are made on committees, I'll remind the body that this afternoon at 2 o'clock, we will hear we will hear the governor speaking in joint session with the Senate. So if anybody planned committee meetings at that time, it would not be possible. Also remind the body that tomorrow, this appears on your calendar sheet that's on your desk, but tomorrow at 1:30, there will be an orientation for freshmen from 1:30 probably to about 2:30. So Chairman might keep that in mind as well.
Committee. Thank you, Mr. Miller. Under committee announcements, Mr. Parr.
Mr. Speaker, the House Committee will have its first meeting, a very short one, at 3 o'clock this afternoon or upon completion of the governor's speech, whichever comes first. And that will be in room 112, which is the first floor of this building on the end to our right as we sit here, for those members who may not know what it is.
Other committee announcements, Mr. Cooper.
Mr. Speaker, the Finance Committee will meet immediately after the governor's speech this afternoon.
Mr. Bradley.
Mr. Speaker, State Affairs will meet at 1 o'clock for a brief get acquainted meeting and for the assignment of seats.
Mr. Miles.
Majority Caucus will meet immediately after this meeting.
Mr. Miles announces the Majority Caucus will meet upon the recess of the House. Mr. Urien. Is there any other business to come before the House at this time? Mr. Brown.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to inquire. I notice we have freshman orientation tomorrow. It's been mentioned to me by more than one person who have been hired or believe they'll be hired by that time in positions of administrative assistant and like that, who probably know at least as little and probably much less about the operations of the House as these freshmen. Is there a possibility there could be participation in at least part of this by some of these employees?
Mr. Miller.
Speaker, the Legislative Affairs Agency always conducts a orientation for employees as well, and that covers not only the material that will be covered for the legislative orientation tomorrow, but it'll go into a lot of the other administrative and clerical responsibilities that are even more important. So the thing tomorrow would not be for staff, it'll be for freshmen. No more announcements, Mr. Speaker. I'll move and ask unanimous consent this body stand in recess until 1:45.
Hearing no objection, so ordered.
Senator Collado.
Mr. President, I would move and ask unanimous consent to the roll call for the Senate be waived and all members be shown as present.
Is there any objection to the motion by Senator Collado? So ordered. Representative Miller.
Mr. President, I'll move and ask unanimous consent that the roll call of the House be waived and that all members be shown as present.
You've all heard the motion by Representative Miller. Is there any objection? So ordered. I'll appoint Representative Hagen and Senator Collado to escort the governor to the chamber.
still ahead a little bit.
Ladies and gentlemen, Governor of State of Washington, Dan Hammond.
To the Constitution and the laws of the state of Alaska, the governor of the state is to give the legislature and the people of Alaska a budget message on the fourth day. That date has arrived. Ladies and gentlemen of the state of Alaska and members of the legislature, it gives me great pleasure to present Governor Jay Hammond.
Speaker, members of the legislature, fellow Alaskans. Today, I wish to focus your attention on reality. Reality is that for years, we have spent far more for ongoing governmental operations than we took in through ongoing taxes. Reality is that if the budget grows at the more than 20% annual average rate it has since statehood, our anticipated revenue 10 years from now will be about $1 billion short of a $4.3 billion budget, which would grow to $26.4 billion by 1997. Reality is that it costs us about $300 more per citizen each year for state services, and we get back in the form of taxes. And that's a great improvement over what it was 2 years ago. Reality is that we have 3.9 state employees per 100 citizens, the highest percentage in the nation. Reality is that state employee salaries have increased 226% during a period of time the cost of living rose only 81.5%. Reality is that the tax on a gallon of gas is the same as it was in 1961, when it provided about $400,000 more than needed to maintain our roads. The shortfall now is $28 million. Reality is that the liquor tax has not gone up in 15 years, and that shortfall costs Alaskans at least $10 million annually for problems caused by alcohol. Reality is that failure to hang recurring tax ballast on ballooning government has permitted it to float upward to where it requires us to borrow about $200 million annually so that we may ride now and let our children pay the trip expenses later. There's a common misconception that Alaska is on easy street financially. We encounter it in Washington when we seek federal funds to repair pipeline construction and damage done our highways. We encounter it at the collective bargaining table during employee wage negotiations. We encounter it at public meetings when irate citizens who resent some local program being rendered from the budget. The simple truth is that while easy street can be just around the corner, there's a few dark alleys we must navigate before we're there. Like New York City, we've already taken more than one wrong turn. Perhaps the worst was when we ceased to pay for programs as we go and started to pay for them from non-recurring revenues gleaned from oil leases. New York City got into trouble for furnishing services beyond its willingness to pay for from ongoing taxes, by acceding to demands of its employees, and for providing lavish unfunded pensions. Sound familiar? While New York fell into financial pitfalls they'd been digging at for years, they did it without the help of a windfall oil bonus. With our $900 million shove, how much more spectacular Alaska's plunge will be unless we take tough action now. We first wandered from firm financial ground when blinded by the glow of those $900 million oil bonus dollars. Instead of using bonus money for capital expenditures or sound investments, we used them to expand governmental operations. Now that the $900 million has been exhausted, we must either curtail services, increase appropriate taxes, borrow on future revenues, or lease more oil land so the books will balance. While wisdom suggests curtailing services or raising taxes, politics makes such difficult. Yet to borrow on future revenues or sell leases to expand state services is unconscionable, if we care about the legacy we leave our children when such revenues run out. Ongoing government operations should be funded from appropriate ongoing revenue measures, such as income, user, or corporate taxes, or interest earnings, not from the principal itself. By feeding principal into ongoing government operations, we condition people to believe we can provide increased services without increasing as well appropriate means of paying for them as we go. Once the public has been so conditioned, few politicians have the fortitude to take remedial action, preferring instead to leave the piper's bills to their successors. Now that's understandable. To pay as we're going this year would require, for example, that we either eliminate about $200 million worth of services we now borrow for, or fund those services from, say, a doubled income tax. Few politicians bent on re-election would even point this out, much less attempt to do a thing about it. And after all, we don't really have to do a thing about it. We could continue the same unsound financial practices for years. Yet the moment oil begins its journey from Prudhoe Bay, it likewise begins its steady progress toward depletion. How we address that fact and use wealth from our non-renewable resources will be two major issues facing us this session. We together share responsibility for Alaska's long-term financial health. Should we continue to rely on Prudhoe oil for our largest slice of daily bread, the prognosis is a poor one. This legislature may be the very last to have the time, the opportunity, and the courage to do what must be done to shift to a more healthy diet. I hope I do not miss a session. In the belief that I have not, I ask you to join me in placing concern for re-election subordinate to whatever efforts are required to nurse this state back to stability and health. Your children at least will love you for it, and who knows, maybe a lot more voters than you think will understand. Unless we set budgetary limits, shift to sounder means of funding government, confine state services to those which citizens want enough to pay for as they go, we'll all be party to handing Alaskans of the future a ticking time bomb. I, for one, don't want to be party to that action. I refuse to be party to it. Thus, for the next 2 years at least, I intend to do everything I can to make certain that I won't be, but I have to have your help. One way we can, together, defuse that time bomb is to resist all efforts to expand governmental operations unless there is at least a commensurate increase in recurring revenues derived from appropriate sources. How can we, in good conscience, expand $1 more in salaries or expanded services if it requires us to dip further into non-renewable resource revenue principle? I realize that in the final analysis, the governor can best assure this does not happen. However, the legislature can either help or hinder monumentally. You can, of course, increase or add new programs while failing to provide new funding from appropriate revenue sources, and thus compel me to wear the hat for vetoing all those popular new programs. Or you can join me in what I believe to be the most significant thing we can do for all Alaskans in the future: condition ourselves to pay as we go for government. Certainly, smart politics dictates the former course, but principle demands the latter. Each of us will have to make that choice. In order to evidence my determination to shift to the latter course, I propose that for fiscal year 1978, we have a basic recurring budget ceiling of $786.3 million. This figure can be funded 39% from recurring revenues and 61% from direct petroleum revenues, estimated for receipt in fiscal 1978. Services requiring appropriations in excess of this amount must be considered incremental budget items to be funded and provided only if Alaskan taxpayers are willing to pay for those increased services through increased charges. Added to the recurring budget, there are two large new exceptional expenditures which would be covered 100% by direct petroleum revenues. These are the Native Land Claims Settlement payment of $40 million and the emergency $27 million appropriation for a desperately needed correctional facility in Anchorage. Thus, should no change in recurring revenues come about through the legislature's rejection of tax measures such as I'll propose, my total general fund budget would be $853.8 million. One point I wish to underscore is that recurring $786 million portion of the budget must be funded at least 39% from recurring revenues. This is the same percentage relationship proposed in my last year's budget. We cannot yet reduce our direct dependence on oil and shift it to recurring revenues. We must, at a minimum, not allow such dependency to increase. Our bottom line must be that our dependency on oil revenues for recurring costs of government must not exceed 61%. Hopefully, we will instead begin to roll it back. Once the legislative budget is structured in legislative action or inaction on recurring revenue proposals known, it will become my unpleasant duty to assure that the relationship between additional appropriations and additional revenues start to reduce our dangerous direct dependence upon petroleum. Should sufficient revenues not be passed to cover recurring costs, so that we may at least retain that 39 to 61% ratio, I will have no recourse but to exercise the powers of this office to ensure that such relationship does not get worse. Should present estimates of recurring revenues prove low, such excess will be used further to enhance this relationship and not obviate the need for passage of additional revenue measures before providing expanded services. Birth of non-renewable resource development in Alaska gave birth as well to wondrous expectations. Yet what was conceived in hope will assuredly abort in dismay unless we take hard action now. Should we not act now, as years pass by, it will become increasingly difficult to jolt ourselves and in turn the public back to proper course. Last year, for example, to hold the current budget to even a moderate rate of growth, I had to set a ceiling and adhere to it by slicing some $20 million from the legislature's budget. Naturally, many legislators were angered when what they viewed as vital programs for their districts were excised. It's not that they were unconcerned. It's just that while everyone is for fiscal restraints in general, almost no one is for it in particular when it impacts them. And that's understandable. Every district has crying needs. Legislators would not be doing their job expected of them if they didn't try to meet those needs. However, I note the presence here today of virtually every legislator who pled with me not to veto crucial items for their districts. They argued re-election was contingent upon bringing home the bacon. Obviously, such was not the case. Nor did fattening the budget help governors in election years. One governor's budget shot up 71% in his fourth year. Another went up more than 40. Yet both lost their bid for re-election. In my own case, nowhere did my line item vetoes more harshly impact than in Bethel. Yet the results of a recent poll indicate that nowhere am I more popular. Conversely, the only election I have lost came in the wake of my most successful legislative session. Perhaps this all suggests that bacon does not win one the points we thought it did. Could be the opposite is true. I intend to test this theory further and urge you all to join me in saying no when necessary. After all, I'm not interested in hogging all the glory. But simply saying no is not sufficient. We should be prepared as well to say yes, if we can afford it. To find out what we can truly afford, let's put price tags on proposed services and ask recipients of those services if they want them enough to pay for them as they go, at least to a more appropriate extent. It's time to stop trying to lull the public into believing the cost of services are paid for by someone else. Of course, it's easier and a lot more fun to tap oil revenues than impose taxes on consumers. Want to expand highway maintenance? Sell leases in the Beaufort Sea. For heaven's sakes, don't raise the gas tax. Increasing problems related to alcohol consumption? Put on a few more troopers, share some revenues, or expand our social services. But don't raise the liquor tax from what has been for 15 years. Instead, let's boost the oil severance tax, and so on and on and on. Such has been the way this state, unfortunately, once did business. Those who point to with pride to the fact that they have never raised your taxes perhaps should be ashamed, for they have set the stage for uncontrolled government expansion. But don't blame them. I almost got lured into playing that same game of Russian roulette with our oil leases. 2 years ago, the state faced a shortfall of over $200 million. Now, the easiest way to balance the books appeared to be a sale in the Beaufort Sea. Though neither prepared to make such a sale nor expecting so favorable a price as we could get under more auspicious circumstances, our financial plight seemed to demand it. However, instead, we substituted the reserve tax. Yet, is a reserve tax any more appropriate means of funding day-to-day governmental operations, since it, too, someday will be gone? We have too long been living off our capital by selling assets to meet day-to-day costs of operations which should have been met by income. I have likened this before to a short-sighted farmer selling off his land instead of crops to pay the hired hands. It simply makes no sense. We must begin reducing our dependence on oil revenues for recurring state operations. It's the only sane, responsible route for us to follow. Now, I have mentioned my determination not to permit our dependence upon non-recurring oil revenues to exceed 39% in the fiscal 1978 recurring budget. Because of pipeline activity, the actual percentage of revenues derived from sources other than oil royalties and taxes increased sufficiently to fund 54% of our current fiscal year recurring budget. While I would far prefer to sustain this higher percentage level of reliance on appropriate sources, to do so next year with diminished pipeline activity would require either a shocking tax increase or drastic reduction in state services. Since neither is realistic, the very least we have to do is hold the line this year and then make a concerted effort to shift our percentage of reliance from oil resources to recurring income sources so that when oil is depleted, we will avoid financial chaos. If additional recurring revenue proposals pass this session, I propose a second incremental budget for your consideration. This would include $6.6 million in capital projects, which I believe should be next in line for funding. These are not included in the appropriation bill submitted here today, but are in the budget documents submitted for your consideration. Additionally, I've included funding in the incremental budget for new legislation totaling $8 million. However, this should not be passed unless there is passed as well means of securing increased recurring revenues to cover related costs. I'm not unwilling to provide needed services, nor am I unwilling to present the appropriate recurring tax measures to pay for them. I demonstrated that last year by submitting measures which would, if passed, have reduced our dependency on depleting resources. Once again, I wish to demonstrate that I am not inflexible by offering choices instead of ordering inflexible constraints. Should you wish not to provide new recurring revenues, it will of course be necessary to carve into my recurring $786 million budget proposal to fund what new legislation you might prefer. At tax measures I suggest as means of providing appropriate recurring revenues would engender $34.2 million, some of which could be used to expand our $786 million recurring budget. However, not all of this should fund new programs. Much should be used to reduce our percentage of direct dependency on oil. Otherwise, we simply mark time and space. These proposed tax measures are not only aimed at increasing recurring revenue, but also should increase recipient awareness of costs required by state services and how those costs are met. Currently, costs to services are far greater than what recipients pay. It didn't used to be that way before we got hooked on that $900 million habit. Of course, we were patsies for addiction. After all, we'd not raised the tax on liquor, cigarettes, gasoline, or auto registration since 1961. Instead, we mainlined oil revenue into highway maintenance and problems caused by alcohol. That oil supply dries up. Withdrawal pangs will aggravate in direct proportion. We must start to kick that habit now by shifting to other more healthy funding sources. One should be a gasoline tax increase. Our current tax will produce only $18 million in 1978. Whereas highway operation and maintenance will cost about $46 million. This means that unless we have a gas tax increase, we will have to provide highways with a $28 million subsidy. To help offset that subsidy, I'm proposing a gas tax increase of 5 cents a gallon, which would provide $11.3 million more in recurring revenues. A crippling tax increase? Hardly. To the Alaskan who drives 12,000 miles a year and gets 15 miles per gallon, this increased cost would amount to but $40 annually. I will also introduce a bill which could increase private vehicle licenses from $30 to $50 and prorate commercial vehicle licenses in such a way as to bring in an estimated $8.8 million. Together, these should be sufficient to virtually cover state highway costs from appropriate revenues paid by users. We currently tax watercraft fuel at 4 cents a gallon and provide an exemption for non-propulsion fuel use, which unfortunately is frequently abused. I urge the legislature to increase the tax and modify the exemption. They did so last year, they chose not to do so. This year, I again propose a tax increase of 2 cents a gallon plus a modified exemption. If we have no tax change, the existing tax will provide but $1,400,000 in revenue next year. However, should my proposal pass, increasing recurring revenues by $1.3 million, I propose that additional projects totaling $2.3 million be added to those already programmed. You may, of course, see fit to adjust these priorities. I ask only that you adhere to the basic premise that new programs obligate new revenue. Our alcohol tax, unchanged for 15 years, is falling short by at least $10 million to paying direct state costs attributable to alcohol. This, too, we've all been forced to subsidize. To reduce that subsidy and shift the burden to where it properly belongs, I'll introduce a bill increasing alcoholic beverage taxes. Only should you pass it can we hope to provide the necessary alcohol prevention and rehabilitation programs, which I am proposing. This tax translates, incidentally, into but 3 cents more per shot. One serious problem with our consumer taxes have been they've not kept up with inflation. For example, had the cost of living adjustments been programmed into our alcohol tax back in 1961, the current tax would now approximate that which I proposed to you this session. Had the highway fuel tax been allowed to float with inflation? Last year, it would have been 14 cents per gallon and would have brought in an additional 15 million. Similarly, tobacco and liquor taxes would now be 81% higher and would certainly fund existing programs. In the belief that it's better late than never to prevent this problem from recurring, I'm introducing a measure which would adjust tax rates for inflations. Now, I do not, of course, delude myself into thinking my tax proposals will be enthusiastically embraced. However, if they're not enacted, it will be difficult to provide services even at past levels, much less absorb new programs. One favorite game of those who comment on the budget is to make comparisons between it and those of other years. Statistics will no doubt be used by some to paint us as wild spendthrifts. Well, we'll attempt to use them, of course, to show how we've pinched pennies. Strip away the politics and the posturing, and it boils down to simply this. Compare recurring operational expenditures in one year to those funded in another. It's the recurring budgets which are the most difficult to trim. If one excludes from our $853.8 million total budget such exceptional non-operational items as the $40 million toward native land claims and the $27 million needed to meet the correctional facilities emergency, there remains a recurring of $786 million for 1978 to compare with the $703 million recurring budget for this fiscal year, an increase of 11.9%. No matter how we or anyone else tries to juggle figures, this percentage is the true measure of just what's happening, the year-to-year comparison of day-to-day costs of operation. The budget we propose calls for the establishment of 375 new positions. This is the lowest number requested by any governor in 13 years, or rather 11 years, and amounts to but a 3.7% increase, whereas the average annual percentage increase in statehood has been about 10%. Of those new positions, 70 are required to operate recently completed capital projects approved by the legislature and the voters. 103 are new positions funded at least 50% by federal and other non-general fund sources. 41 are for the court system, 12 for the legislature, and some few others are mandated by federal regulation. For the University of Alaska General Fund appropriation, I propose a maintenance budget as defined by the Board of Regents in the amount of $64 million plus whatever costs are incurred through collective bargaining agreements and salary increases. Though you'll be under extreme pressure to boost this upward, in view of our financial circumstances and in light of other needs, the 12% increase we've provided for should be considered adequate. One blessing of holding down state spending is that there is no lengthy laundry list to be inserted in the budget message. However, we have a short list: a new Lakati class ferry for Southeast Alaska, a new pioneer's home for Anchorage, 200 lane miles of new state highways will be opened. State trooper and wildlife protection agents will increase in number. Petroleum revenue collection capabilities will be improved, as will data acquisition for program operation of the Department of Health and Social Services. Department of Natural Resources will acquire more oil and gas research capabilities. Fish and Game will commence operation of a number of salmon hatcheries destined for construction during 1978. At the same time, we hope to have implemented almost 70% of the recommendations of the cost efficiency study. This should result over a 24-month period in a net financial savings of more than $38 million. While we can exercise control over some factors which increase the cost of government, one control was partially relinquished in 1972 by the legislature with passage of the Collective Bargaining Act for state employees. Since then, marathon negotiations have extracted major additional expenditures each year under threat of crippling strike. I believe state employees should have the best salaries possible, commensurate with revenues available from appropriate sources. However, since we are currently obligated to borrow $200 million from future revenues just to pay our current bills, appropriate revenues clearly are not yet available. Regardless, I want employee paychecks to keep pace with the cost of living. Beyond that, our current fiscal circumstances simply cannot logically accommodate increased pay or benefits. Well, I would much prefer to say yes than no to state employees. I must remain firm in this regard. Now, some charge that such attitudes are prompted by antagonism towards state employees. Not so. While it's easy to fire cheap shots at all the bureaucrats and assert that those who work for government are unproductive parasites, I've come to admire and respect innumerable state employees with whom I've had contact. Moreover, state employees should be assured that as Alaska prospers, they prosper also. As long as I'm in office, such will be the case. But that doesn't mean that I will not again say no. I'm not insensitive to the needs of state employees. It's simply that I'm even more sensitive to the needs of all Alaskans. The legislature turned over almost all control of a major budgetary item to the executive when they passed collective bargaining. I'd not be at all affronted should you choose to take it back. Curiously, however, to date, there seems little aspiration for our reacquisition of this power, though attempts to extract other powers from this office have been commonplace. Should this legislature choose to once again more fully control your mandated powers of appropriation, I would be pleased to at least share this action with you. And don't think for a moment you'll lose the support of all employees automatically, should you too say no when necessary. After all, the average state employee is just as concerned about our financial health as you or anyone, if not more so. Most are not intent on bleeding the state white for everything they can drain from it. They realize they are the vitals of the state, and as it prospers or debilitates, so as well do they. Most state employees who understand our financial circumstances and this administration's true intent seem to share both our concerns and our objectives, though many already understand, others have not yet received the message. This is shown in the following verbatim excerpts from two letters I received last week. The first reads, "It has always appeared to me you do not regard state employees very highly, and in retaliation wish to lower our wages and benefits. If you succeed, you will inevitably worsen our economy while receiving the self-satisfaction of punishing employees. I'm glad I'm not in your shoes, for I sure wouldn't want that hanging over my head." The second letter reads, "Like hundreds of other state employees, I realize that for the sake of honesty and fiscal sanity, this clamor for more money and benefits must end at some point in time, and that time is now. I'm perfectly satisfied with my wages and benefits. Most state employees are. Public employees would not be clamoring for more at this time were it not necessary for union representatives to make some attempt at self-justification. It is my hope that legislation will be forthcoming to repeal collective bargaining," unquote. There it is, take a choice. Apparently, political points lost, with some for saying no, could well be made up for among the more perceptive. And I believe they are in the distinct majority. Conclusion, let me say to those environmentalists who believe I dwell too much on economics that unless we create a quality economy within this state, the likelihood of creating or retaining a quality environment will die a mourning. Unless we shift from past economic practice in desperation to acquire sufficient revenues to sustain our recurring services, future governors will be compelled to exploit as rapidly as possible a frantic future game of catch-up in which everybody loses. Without a quality economy, we simply never will quite achieve sufficient time or money to convince politicians that we can afford the luxury of doing things the way we'd like to have them done. I believe this legislature, more clearly than any other, perceives the need for taking actions now which in the long term could accrue to all our credit. What's more, I believe this legislature and this administration may be the last which could possibly take those actions. If I could do what's necessary all by myself and spare you having to jeopardize your political careers, I'd be pleased to do so. Though I might like you to believe such attitude was prompted by aspirations to some sort of noble martyrdom, I confess it's because I had a good thing going for me on the outside of politics and would not be crushed if compelled to resume it. However, that's pretty hard to do voluntarily in satisfaction until this job is done. If I have your full and joyous cooperation, who knows? Perhaps within the next 2 years, we together actually might do it. Otherwise, I guess I'll just have to join you on the stump in 1978. Thank you.
Is there any further business to come before the joint session? Senator Coletta.
Mr. President, I move to ask unanimous consent to the joint session and stand in adjournment.
Just before we adjourn, I want to announce that the Senate will reconvene in the Senate chambers only for purposes of adjourning. I would request that the minority-majority leaders be there for the adjournment motion. There being no other business, the joint session is adjourned.
House, please stand at ease. House, please come to order. Mr. Miller.
Mr. Speaker, a brief notation before we adjourn. I'd like to move and ask unanimous consent that that today's journal reflect the fact that Representatives Guy and Byrne were actually sworn in by the Lieutenant Governor on the 10th. And were in chambers on that day. Because of the quorum call situation, they were not reflected as present. It would be sufficient to show it in today's journal, but they were in attendance at that time. If there's no further announcements, Mr. Speaker, I'll place an adjournment motion.
Mr. Miller has moved and asked unanimous consent on his motion. Is there objection to the motion? Hearing no objection, motion's adopted, Mr. Miller.
There are no further announcements, Mr. Speaker. I'll move and ask unanimous consent this body stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Hearing no objection, it's adopted.